Hey there, it's MHP, and thanks for staying with us on The Takeaway.
Oh, beautiful, far heroes proved in liberating strife.
We're listening to Ray Charles' revolutionary rendition of America the Beautiful, the groundbreaking album, A Message from the People, which debuted on April 4th, 1972, and marking a pivotal moment in the career of one of the most influential artists of the 20th century.
America!
Through the album's tracks, Charles touched on social injustices like poverty, while offering up a hopeful melody for a world torn apart by war, inequality, and dispossession. Many of the issues that Charles sang about in that time still resonate with listeners today. Earlier this month, Tangerine Records released the album on vinyl, CD, and streaming services for the first time in more than a decade. And I spoke about the re-release with John Burke, a record producer and head of Tangerine Records, who produced Ray Charles's final studio album, Genius Loves Company.
One of the albums, it's the 50th anniversary of Ray's most socially conscious album ever, which is A Message from the People. And, you know, in this album, he tackled societal problems, the plight of the common man, patriotism, injustice, and it's incredibly relevant today. I mean, songs like, for example, Heaven Help Us All, you know, some of the lyrics are Heaven Help Us All When the Bombs Begin to Fall.
And heaven help the man who gave that child a gun into the shame.
And, you know, when I look at the news, I think, well, I mean, it's just so relevant. Other songs like, you know, There'll Be No Peace Without All Men Is One, Lift Every Voice and Sing, Abraham, Martin, and John.
Because we're the richest country in the world, and I just can't understand why we got so many hungry people. You know, I believe we ought to say something like this. Hey, mister, you better listen.
Hey, mister, which is an interesting song, it was played at a congressional hearing in 1972 as, you know, making Ray Charles the voice of the common American citizen who felt that government was ignoring some of their needs. And then there's also, you know, the real patriotism of this album. I mean, probably the most significant track on the album is America the Beautiful, which became our second national anthem. And, you know, there's just nothing like it ever recorded. One of the most seminal renditions of all time.
Let's talk about America the Beautiful, because it is a recording, a version, an interpretation, a rendering that absolutely alters the very meaning and reception of what those lines even mean. Can you talk to us a bit about what it is? Because sometimes I'm experiencing it sonically, but I'm not sure I have the language to describe why it is that America the Beautiful sounds entirely different and hits my sometimes less than fully patriotic ear very differently when I hear him sing it.
Well, you know, I guess the first thing I would say is that was the magic of Ray Charles. He somehow embodied so much life experience and put it into his music in a way that was so relatable to all of us. I mean, I give an example. One time when we were recording together, I wanted him to re-sing one little section of one song. And it was kind of funny. He said to me, you know, no, I ain't doing that. And we have to admit, I was a little intimidated by him sometimes. I didn't push it.
That seems fair.
And then you know, when we were kind of using a more jovial mood, we were joking around about something. I said, hey, by the way, what do you think about it? You sure you want to revisit that section? And he said, I told you, I ain't doing it. And so that was the end of that conversation that day. And then finally, on the third day, I thought I'd take one more shot at it. And he said to me, listen, son, that's when I was feeling it. And that's what you want. And I think that kind of says everything about the way Ray sang. Is he put himself inside the song. And when he was believing it, that was the performance. And somehow we found a way to get inside that song in a way that just made it universal. And, you know, I think the song, it speaks to the beliefs and the values that we all hope America is going to be, and highlights the beauty of that and what we have achieved. But it also, somehow we bring some of the pain of our shortcomings.
The title of the final studio album is Genius Loves Company. So who cultivated the genius? Who helped to bring that genius out of him? I'm thinking of you saying, sometimes I was a little intimidated, which seems really more than fair. But I've seen genius at work, and sometimes it responds really well to those who refuse to be intimidated, who are like, come on, no, you're going to feel it now, or what about feeling it this way? Who could talk to Ray Charles like that? Who could bring that out in him?
Well, you know, I wish I could say it was me, but Ray brought it out of him. Ray taught me a lot, about how to make that work. I think the other thing that I learned in making that record with him was, the real art of a duets record is, how do you find the song and the arrangement that allows both artists to shine in their unique talent? And that's the real challenge of a record like that, and finding that framework. And we went through a lot of songs to find the right songs for each pairing. And so that was one of the key things, was really finding the right song. And then the other thing, which this I did suggest to Ray, was, I don't want to do it. We were kind of coming off the Sinatra duets, which are so successful. And I remember saying to him that I think that, if you do, you're one of the few people that can really do a record like that, but I want to do it where you're face to face with the other singers, and we're not doing this remotely. And that was a game changer, because when people got in a room with Ray, sparks would fly, especially, people of the caliber of talent that came to that record. And the other thing that I wanted to do, and he was in support of, was, let's only bring people who really get you, who really want to do this. I don't want to force any of these things, but everybody that came to that record really knew Ray, really loved Ray, knew his history, and had the utmost respect for him. So everybody sort of upped their game when you're singing with Ray Charles, as you can imagine.
He is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's in the R&B Hall of Fame. He was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. This has been a theme in many of my music conversations recently. But do we even need genre? Is there a way to recognize just the genius without the genre? What does it mean to be sitting here in rock and roll, R&B, and country? What does that tell us about not only Ray Charles, but about the ways that genre feeds or potentially could feed one another?
Well, it's interesting. We did this Live in Stockholm record came out of a box set we put together for Ray's 90th birthday called True Genius. And the theme of that box was how Ray was able to be incredibly successful in virtually every genre. Jazz, blues, he's considered the genius of soul for creating soul music by combining, gospel and R&B. And then he took a left turn and made the biggest crossover country record of the day, and actually put country on the map with I Can't Stop Loving You and in his Modern Sounds in Country and Western albums. Was totally game changing. And even in those records, it's not just country music. He selected country songs, but he had jazz arrangements, he had R&B arrangements, he had pop. There really wasn't a genre in his nearly six decades of recording that he didn't somehow conquer in his own way, or find a way to do it that was uniquely Ray Charles. And that was the whole point of that box. And that's how we sort of, we wanted to put some unreleased material on that box, and found, and digging through the vaults of, and there's a lot of stuff in the vaults, right? But finding something, first of all, was really, really well recorded that was live. And we found this set in Stockholm that was recorded the same year as Message from the People, 1972. We thought that was interesting too. So 50 years later, this is another one that really holds up. I mean, in 1972, Ray was at the peak of his powers. He was touring Europe, and this one night was just so full of great energy and unbelievable performances and some rarities that, we started pulling tracks, and we thought, wait a minute, this could be a whole album on its own. So we put that in as a bonus album in the True Genius box, and then are just releasing it wide now. But, you know, the True Genius title actually came from a quote from Frank Sinatra, who said, "The only true genius in our business is Ray Charles." Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of the theme there. It's what you were just talking about. The genres didn't really exist to him. And even when he stepped inside of a genre, he bent it and then brought other forms of music in. So, you know, I think for him, it was, you know, there's good music. And what was it? I guess it was it Ellington that said that, you know, there's good music and there's bad music and that's it. Right. I think it's remarkable. I don't know that there's another artist that's done what he's done still. And I think it's also kind of remarkable that, you know, and the genre designation was somewhat an organizational mechanism by the industry, right? So you remember record stores, we had jazz bins, we had blues bins, we had, you know, pop bins, we had all that, right? But I think from a musical standpoint, and what we're seeing now is that audiences don't care as much. Now that in the world of streaming, and I think it's very true of younger generations, the genre designation is not that meaningful. Maybe not meaningful at all. And the consumers seem to be much more open to whatever.
Across just, you know, but, you know, you just look at right at the middle of Genius Loves Company, right? And there's Elton John, Bonnie Raitt, Michael McDonald, and Gladys Knight, like back to back, and James Taylor, right? Like just right through there, that very notion of, and, you know, I think maybe B.B. King and Willie Nelson are next to each other, all in conversation with, all in this creation with Ray Charles. It's hard to imagine another artist who could have done that range.
Right. Isn't that interesting? The other thing that's interesting about the people that showed up for that record is they all have, like Ray did, these incredibly distinctive voices. Mm-hmm. Right? Like when you hear Johnny Mathis sing, it's only Johnny Mathis. No one else sounds like him at all. Right? I mean, Elton John, everybody you named, you know, Gladys Knight, you know, I hate to leave anybody.
Michael McDonald. Yeah, absolutely.
Every single person on that record, though, had that. And something, it sort of dawned on me after we had it all recorded, and looking at it and putting it together, you know, mixing and all that, it seemed like, wow, everybody has such unique character to their voice. Monty Raitt, oh my God. Norah Jones. Really, everybody. I mean, you know, James Taylor. Who sounds like James Taylor? Funny thing is, James told me, you know, I always wanted to sound like Ray, but I don't have that voice. I thought that was interesting. And kind of insightful when you hear James sing, because he does do some of those riffs, but he has such a different character. It's such a, you know, such a unique character. I've heard people say that, you know, James Taylor has the voice of God. It's so pure. And Ray is, you know, Ray's voice was full of grit and, you know, just incredible character. But yeah, I think the he could uniquely unify all those people, right? I mean, Willie Nelson to B.B. King to, you know, all of them. And that also illustrates that. He really did sort of defy genre designation throughout his career.
Let's talk about Tangerine Records a little bit. First of all, tell me a little bit more about it so that folks who don't follow that part of music will know a little bit about Tangerine Records. And then I want to know what's next.
Well, Tangerine Records is interesting in that, you know, Ray was also a maverick in business, in the record business. And one of the things he did early on that I don't know if any other artist had done it before is he insisted that he own his own masters. And that was part of a bigger concept of his, is that he wanted to own everything. So he owned his masters, he owned his publishing, he built his own studio, he bought his own tour bus, he built his offices, he had his own management company. He was literally self-contained and self-sufficient. When he formed his own label, it was Tangerine Records. He had another one too called Crossover, but the first one was Tangerine. And this was about him as an independent artist with an independent label. And what kind of resonates is, you know, I've always been in independent music, and we have a new company called Acceleration Music, which is there are five partners, and our mission is to support independent music and independent labels and independent artists and finding ways to do that. So we've also had a long relationship with the Ray Charles Foundation going back to when, you know, I was fortunate enough to produce Ray. And so we came together and decided to relaunch Tangerine Music, which the depth there is incredible, because not only does it have Ray's records, everything since 1962, basically. And he did release it on different imprints from time to time, but everything came back to him. And so, and that's his label. So we're releasing everything on Tangerine now. But within that catalog, there's a ton of other stuff. There's early Fifth Dimension. There's early Ike and Tina Turner. There's Percy Mayfield, who recorded a lot of Ray's big hits before Ray did. And Ray was doing re-records, which, you know, took off. But there's a lot of great jazz in there. It's a really incredible catalog. And what's next, and what we're thinking about down the road, is how do we start to reintroduce all that material, because there's a wealth of really beautiful, interesting music. I mean, he obviously was a great musician, but he also could recognize great artists and great musicians, and he used his platform to try and elevate them and get their music out there. So there's that for sure, you know, wealth of material to look into. And then of course there's more Ray Charles stuff. There's quite a bit more. So we're talking, the person who really heads all this up is Valerie Irvin. She's the president of the Ray Charles Foundation. And she's the person that Ray Charles and Joe Adams entrusted with managing the legacy going forward. So it's a wonderful organization. She's amazing. And what they do is, the money they generate, they generally give it away for Black education and for hearing disorders. And research and help in that area. Because Ray's philosophy was that, you know, being blind is not a handicap, but being deaf would be a major handicap. Mm. And so that's their mission. It's a beautiful thing. They do great work in that area. And then, of course, they have this amazing catalog of both, you know, everything Ray did since 1960, basically. I think it's there's one country duets record and maybe a couple other things that are elsewhere. But and then it's all that wealth of catalog from artists that he admired and wanted to put out into the world. So those are the things we're going to be digging into going forward.
I love this idea of Charles thinking, who needs sight? It's the sonic, it's the sound. It is being able to have the music. That's the key thing.
He had this amazing ability, like, you know, he'd walk down the hall, he'd know where a doorway was because he'd listen to the echo. Right. And so he wore hard shoes. So there were always an echo of when he was walking, and he counted the steps to remember how to get places. And even this is really interesting. In his studio, he could run his studio by himself without anybody there. And so one of the interesting things about organizing, and when we get into the vaults and the tapes and things like that, Ray was in there doing work and there was no one there but him. So there's nothing documented or written down on a lot of these tapes. And the way that he would organize them was by placement. So God help you if you moved a tape. You know what I mean? yeah, he was just an extraordinary guy, and he was able to figure out everything. And obviously, you know, I mean, I think that for him, it wasn't a handicap, didn't hold him back at all. The thing that would have been, you know, a loss for humanity and culture would have been if Ray couldn't have heard music.
I love you telling the story of him running his own studio, and I'm smiling in my mind just thinking of my director and my board op right now, thinking, "Hey, that is no small trick to run that control room on your own." John Burke, record producer, Ray Charles collaborator, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, really, a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Is one. Amen. Amen.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.